Mikey, good to be in contact with you. Rory Shiner here from over in Perth, replying to your very stimulating and encouraging and eye-opening, mind-opening episode, as you helped us to think a bit about concupiscence, about its truth, its limitations, the work it was required to do in the time of Augustine and Pelagius, the work it was doing in the Reformation, and the work it's been enlisted in now. And it's a great question. It feels like there's two things going on in your episode. One is the concupiscence itself and the nature of our desires and where they fit in our account of hamartiology, of what it means to be sinful, what it means to be under the power of sin, what it means in our anthropology, what it means to be a creature, and what it means in our contemporary debates. As your episode kind of begins, you talk about the way in which some contemporary debates around sexuality and same-sex attraction and so on have led us in kind of conservative, evangelical, reformed Protestant circles to make distinctions between sin and action, between a desire that comes unbidden and a desire that's entertained, to make distinctions that seem really pastorally intuitive and obvious. But if you take those distinctions to say, you know, it's not a desire to want it, it's a desire to act on it, or it's not a, you know, it's not wrong to have the desire come to you, but it's wrong to entertain it or whatever. Some of these distinctions, we find ourselves doing work that if you took our language and put it back into the 16th century, into the time of the Reformation or into other periods, we find ourselves on the Roman Catholic side of the debate. And so you help us think about those particular issues around desire and its status as sinful or otherwise, and you help us to think at that meta level about what it means to be in a tradition, in our mutual case, the Reformed tradition of the Christian faith, and what to do when you find yourself using language that's come up short, or where you've reached the some sort of limit, and either the tradition is pulling you back, or the tradition itself is limited, or whatever, and what to do in that situation. Anyway, long way of saying, very stimulating, and a whole ton of things going on at once. I started to do the deep dive, and I've kept delaying writing, recording this reply. But I think this is opening up more and more questions. I'm going down more and more rabbit holes. So I thought I'd just stop in with an interim report. Well, that might be the last thing we say about this in this little series. But I thought I'd jump on now and fire off with some thoughts back to you, rather than wait till every problem has been solved. Here's a few things I wanted to say in response. Firstly, I really like the way you helped us to think about what to do when we come up against the edge of our tradition. Because I think, ironically, I'm kind of from a sub-tradition in the in Reformed circles, where we're pretty quick. That if we find a verse that contradicts the tradition, then we go with the verse, and there's a kind of an excitement in the way we handle the Bible in certain circles, and in some of the circles I'm in, where the daring of saying, well, look, you know, the Reformed people say this, but the passage says this, and away we go. And you counsel for a more modest thing to. I think in your episode, you actually say what we should do is accept the tradition and ask if it can see what we can't see. Are there ways in which our tradition should limit us and say, wait a minute, I'm kind of about to jump off and go over here and there and do this and that. But the tradition in which I live and move and have my being causes me to hesitate here, because I might be getting myself into hot water elsewhere, and I haven't haven't even seen it. And I almost need that person from a different culture and time and place to alert me to the mistakes I might be making. My illustration for this one is there was a working bee at a church here in Perth, and it was an old church, a beautiful old church, and it had ivy growing all over it. So it looked like something out of New England or, you know, this kind of beautiful oldie-worldie church. And there was this well-meaning bunch of people on the working bee, and they were chopping away and tidying up the thing, and they were chopping this branch and that branch, and then someone chopped, and they chopped the branch that connected the ivy to the ground. And within a few days, the whole thing went great, you know, went brown, and this kind of, you know, 100-year-old artifice just fell away, and the church is now exposed. It doesn't look quite so pretty anymore without the ivy, because they went and bit, they cut off the wrong bit. And theology, I think, is a bit like that, that we're happily trimming away and chopping away here, there, and everywhere. And a tradition like the Reformed teaching on concupiscence is one of those ones that helps us to say, wait, we're off we go on our pastoral advice and our words of wisdom and so on, but we might end up cutting something that's actually a lifeline to something else, that if we introduce distinctions between desire and action, we might find ourselves inadvertently in a world where we've cut off important teachings about the nature of salvation and baptism and the reach of sin. Then you go on to say that we should critique our traditions, because the reverse is also true, that they might not have formulated it fully, and they might not have seen things that we now face. And I think where you push us toward is to at least ask the question. I'm not implying that you are saying this is the answer, but at least applying the question, are we, as we apply these traditional categories to new problems, at least newly urgent problems around sexuality and so on, whether we might find ourselves, I think this is what you're saying, and this is what we've discussed, might find ourselves using categories and ideas that were being bought in to answer question A or B, or to defend doctrine Y or Z. And if we lift them up out of the context of the debates they were working in, and apply them now without being reflective, we could find that we're using them in a ham-fisted way, or there's some sort of mismatch, like trying to get a PC and a Mac to do stuff together in the 1990s. And I think that is certainly a risk worth addressing. So in the Roman Catholic Catechism, for example, when it talks about concupiscence in part 1, section 2, it talks about, it kind of almost more or less makes that point in its own way, to say that it argues that in the Reformation, well, in the Augustinian debates, Pelagius takes it off in one direction and messes things up. Pelagius, this is ready for the Catechism, held that man could, by natural power of free will, without necessary help of grace, lead a morally good life. He thus reduced the influence of Adam's fault to a bad example. So this is official Roman Catholic doctrine saying exactly what we would say, that Pelagius taught that we could live a morally good life. And what's the problem with that? Protestants and Catholics both agree that just reduces the influence of Adam's fault to a bad example. So we and the Roman Catholic Church want to say to Pelagius, not deep enough. You've got this, Pelagius, you've got this doctrine of sin that doesn't get to the heart of things. If we can live a morally good life under our own steam, if Adam's just a bad example, then Pelagius, where's your deep doctrine of original sin? But then it goes on in the next sentence to say, the first Protestant reformers, on the contrary, taught that original sin had radically perverted man and destroyed his freedom. They identify the sin inherited by each man with the tendency to concupiscence, which would be insurmountable. So what the Catholic Catechism is saying is that us Protestants made the opposite mistake, that Pelagius was just too chilled out about this stuff. He didn't have a deep doctrine of the nature of sin as an inward as well as outward thing. And then the Protestant reformers make the opposite mistake and destroy our freedom. And all I'm noting there is that this is the way you do theology. In this case, this is the Roman Catholic theology. But what they're doing is noting the context in which debates happen and the way that sometimes when you pull too hard and end up losing other things in the process. And the Roman Catholic charge, I guess, according to the Catechism, is that an important doctrine of human freedom has been lost with an overemphasis on concupiscence and its nature, its continuing nature in the Christian, in the baptized and Christian person. Anyway, there you are. That's sort of by the by, but I'm just pointing out that these are the ways that theology works. Theology's not like a discrete set of drawers where you open a drawer and then you shut the drawer and you open the next drawer, and one drawer is about sin and the next drawer is about humanity and the next drawer is about the Trinity, and once you close one, you open the other. Theology is much more like a mobile in a kid's room above the cot or whatever, where if you pull one part of the whole mobile moves, because you can't move one part of it without affecting everything else. And that's a real to me, that's the beautiful thing about theology, well done, that it's like a big kind of Gothic cathedral where every buttress is there to support something that's supporting something else, that's making something else work. And that's part of the beauty of thinking theologically, but also the challenge of thinking through these things. A few things I just wanted to say in a particular response. And again, these are kind of questions back at you rather than answers as such. Firstly, I think this is unremarkable. But I think what is the work that concupiscence and the doctrine of original sin and the sinful nature of our desires is doing? I think the work that it did do in Augustine and it did do in the Reformation and it should still do now is to say that sin affects everything. It can always be tempting to have a doctrine of sin that excludes the thing that you happen to favour. So some Christian theological systems have, in theory or in practice, had a commitment to say that reason is unaffected by sin, that what we think is unaffected, that our ability to reason is unaffected, and therefore we can go to reason, or that we can go to action or whatever. And part of the work of concupiscence is to say, actually, no, sin goes all the way down. There's nowhere in the human person, there's no faculty within the human person that can be uncritically trusted to guide us, whether that is our reason, our will, our emotions, our motivations, and so on. And in that sense, I think it's in its own way, a very sober, but also a very liberating doctrine, because as Karl Barth would say, that the gospel has to make its own landing ground. It doesn't, we aren't those who are scratching around within us looking for the point at which sin has not affected us, because it's affected everything, which makes us as Christians self-critical, or to make us self-critical even of our desires and our wants and our longings. And that's really important. I think it's a very important work of this area of doctrine today, especially in the rise of what Charles Taylor would call expressive individualism, where the highest good, and you see this in every Disney film, is to do what you want, to pursue, to discover the inner you. And we have a huge trust in our own ability, A, to know who the inner you really is, and then B, once discovering it, to express that. It's kind of more or less the contemporary salvation narrative that we live around. I think this doctrine, or this area of theology at least, has more fruitfulness for us still as we face the contemporary situation. Secondly, I think there's work to be done and questions about the nature, what the object of desire does to the status of our desire. And I think you walk between a precipice here. So there is, at one level, there is a silly or just an undercooked pastoral and maybe theological approach to say that that desire is wrong when the wrong thing is desired. So, for example, in the Ten Commandments, the last commandment is, "You shall not covet your neighbor's donkey or your neighbor's wife, your neighbor's possessions." And there, everything. Well, I think one reading of that is to say, what's the problem there? It's not that you coveted, that you desired, but what you coveted, that it did not belong to you. And so you may think about your spouse, or you may think about your own house with impunity, that once the object is acceptable, once the object is lawful, then kind of, you know, it's on for young and old. You can feel however you want toward that thing because it's now within the structure of something that you can legitimately desire. And I think we want to hesitate there and say it's too simplistic to simply say that the thing that you can't desire is the thing that wasn't given to you. That's a particular subset of the sins of desire, to desire that which isn't given to you. But could it be the case? I think it is the case that the effects of sin go right down to us, even the way we go about desiring that which is legitimate to us, our own wife or our own house or our own possessions or whatever. I think the Bible is richer in at least raising the possibility that we could desire those things in a way that is sinful, and certainly concupiscence, and its Greek, the Greek word from which it's the Latin word is derived, has within it that idea not just of desire but of hyper desire, of being dominated, of overly desiring the thing. And I think that has important pastoral implications, because as we come into a situation where some of the things we desire are technically legitimate, some of the things we desire are not legitimate, then we could find ourselves having kind of strange and pastorally unhelpful subsets in the congregation of people who think, oh, well, I'm pretty lusty towards this set of things, but at least they're okay. You know, at least they're in the acceptable range of things that could rightly be mine. And I think we want to stand a bit more shoulder to shoulder in these things with brothers and sisters whose desire may be for a person or a personal thing that is never able to be given to them. So that's one side. Then the other side of the object. So one side is you don't want to be simplistic in saying, well, that object is legitimate, therefore I can desire it however I want. But on the other side, I think, and this will get us to the third point on creatureliness, we do want to, we don't want to get to a point where our understanding of concupiscence and our understanding of desire leads us to say Yeah, I think I'm agreeing with you. Odd or uncreaturely things about the nature of all desire, and especially sexual desire. So, for example, in Gregory of Nyssa argued that if Adam and Eve had not sinned, they would have remained virgins and the human race would have multiplied by whatever method is used by the angels and not by that animal and irrational method by which they now succeed one another. That last bit is a direct quote. That's sending you into some strange areas, I think. And you can see there where the work is being asked to do more than ordered. I think that's a really strange thing to think. And so then you end up with all these speculations. So Gregory is forced to concede. This is from Roger Scruton's book on sexual desire, which is excellent. Gregory is forced to concede, for example, that God distinguished the sexes only in anticipation of the fall. That there's Adam and there's Eve in the garden, and they're oriented toward each other sexually as legitimate objects of desire. But Gregory has to say that's only because he knew the fall was going to happen, and so he set up sex as a prelapsarian concession to what would happen, to which we want to say, or maybe it's the good gift of God. And not just the outward artifact of their engendered sexuality, but you would think, wouldn't you, their inward desire for one another, that they were ordered to the other, that they were going to be drawn to the other. And drawn to the other, this is part of how Roger Scruton accounts for heterosexuality, drawn toward the mystery of the desire of the other, because in the heterosexual case, you know, what you desire, the desire of the other is in some sense, quoting Roger Scruton, a mystery to you. The thing that they want and the pleasure that they will receive is in some sense, mysterious. And so through desire, we're drawn to the otherness of the other and to that process of, you know, in its full and non-sinful sense, the non-narcissistic discovery of the other, including their desire. Their desire is part of what you discover. So anyway, it seems really odd to me to end up in a situation where you're having to, having to speculate about Adam and Eve because you're trying to avoid this thing, and you think, why are we trying to avoid that so hard? What about, are there other options? Augustine, similarly, you know, Augustine says, a man being in unlawful anger with his neighbour had rather have 1,000 eyes upon him than one when he is in carnal copulation with his wife. That's interesting. It's Augustine saying, one would prefer to let all your neighbors see you angry, which is a desire, it's a thing that comes out of your heart, rather than them see you copulating with your wife. And Augustine's making a point about concupiscence and sexual desire, but couldn't that equally just be a feature of our creatureliness? Not that sex is shameful, but that it is private, that it's ordered specifically to that two-ness, to the personhood of the other person. So I think I'm agreeing with you that maybe a way forward here is not to outright reject these valuable contributions of the tradition. And certainly there are points at which we'd want to fight tooth and nail to say, actually, no, sin goes all the way down, and therefore salvation is the gift of grace, and there's no point on which we can stand apart from grace alone, Christ alone. They're making a Protestant point here, that when we're arguing with Catholic friends, part of it is because of this, that we really want to declare that it's Jesus and what he did and his sacrifice alone that saves us from sin, because we really have, in a profound way, lost our freedom and need to be rescued by Jesus all the way down. And it makes important points pastorally and in terms of sanctification to know that the work of God isn't just conforming us outwardly to an external code, but inwardly being renewed in the image of his creator. So very important stuff, but I think I'm with you on the instinct, at least, that there's some creatureliness at work in our desires, which means that desire, unbidden, the way we experience it, the way it comes to us, and even some sort of acknowledgement and participation in it, to see that as necessarily a sinful act in itself, it seems there's a missing creaturely component. And the last thing I want to say as well is, alongside the Bible's, you know, Romans 7 and the its deep sense of our inward brokenness and our inward disorderliness and so on, in terms of the actual trenches of day-to-day existence, you know, Paul says in Galatians 6, the acts of the sinful nature are obvious, fits of rage, selfish ambition. There is a sense in which the introspection of our tradition can be unhelpful, and the acts of the sinful nature. There is a thing where I'm not so much thinking about sexuality as such, but more at the way that in some forms of evangelical piety, we're picking over everything and saying, "Oh, that, you know, I ran that youth group, but that was because, you know, there's some deep need in me that I wasn't finding in Jesus," and so on. And I think there are points there, at least for some personality types, where it's worth saying, do you know what? The acts of the sinful nature are obvious. The things that God is calling us to, they're not always kind of rocket science, and we can just get on with it and joyfully live the lives that God requires and call on him and the work of his spirit to expose our motives without being the kind of, you know, bone diggers that are constantly having to unearth the particulars of every motivation. I think sometimes I think part of a healthy understanding of concupiscence is that we're not competent to do that. Paul in 1 Corinthians says that I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. And we trust the Lord for his judgment. So somewhere between being silly and shallow and being introspective and overly confident on our ability to name our motivations, we should stand before God and entrust our judgment to him and live the lives that he's called us to. Anyway, there's some random thoughts. They could have been clearer, but then they would have taken a lot longer. So there you go. Great to chat. Talk to you again soon. Bye.